Thank you very much. While our panelists take their seats, I want to give the briefest introduction. The title of this session really says it all. Zero Sum, Russia, Power Politics, and the Post-Cold War Era. Is it really the case that we have entered a zero-sum world in U.S.-NATO-Russia relations in which one side wins and one side loses? Or do we still have the possibility of finding accommodation, finding ways out of this quite dark situation of the last year? I hope we'll talk in our conversation today about how we got here, the extent to which the events of the last year have been inevitable or were the result of mistakes that were made and can be reversed. I hope we'll talk about whether Ukraine itself has to be a zero-sum game, whether it's possible, as Zbigniew Brzezinski said, to imagine a future Ukraine that looks east and west at the same time, that is at once in a comfortable relationship with Russia and with Europe, and if so, how would we get there? I hope we'll talk about how NATO should respond to current events and whether NATO can work with Russia to find the exit ramp that President Obama so often has described in this crisis, which would take you out of zero-sum world into a different world. I'll just close this introduction by saying that I found it quite chilling in the sense of falling out of the world in which the Brussels Forum was created 10 years ago, a world that was optimistic, back into the language of the Cold War as I read about President Putin's question during the days of the Crimea events, whether Russian nuclear forces should be put on alert because of the possibility of some Western response. That's a kind of talk, a kind of issue that most of us had thought was very much left behind, was part of a different era, and we're back there now by the account of the President of Russia. So with that introduction, I want to first turn to our new NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, and I want to ask him to begin by addressing the basic question of this session. Are we slipping back into a Cold War situation?
So we are not in a Cold War situation, because that was a global war between two blocks, military blocks. It was an ideological war, and we are not there now. But we are not in the cooperative environment we have tried to establish after the end of the Cold War either. And the reason why we are not in the cooperative environment we have strived so much to establish is that Russia has violated the rules. Russian troops have crossed the borders of its neighbors. They have annexed a part of another country, and that is the first time since the end of the Second World War that has happened in Europe, with the annexation of Crimea. And they have troops in Moldova, in Georgia, and they are destabilizing eastern Ukraine. And NATO has to respond to this, and as a very firm and strong response to this behavior, we are now undertaking the biggest reinforcement of our collective defense since the end of the Cold War. And I think many people are not aware of how fundamental this adaptation is actually. The adaptation that is taking place now is a very big and fundamental adaptation of NATO defense posture. We are doubling the size of our response force. The lead elements of this force will be able to move in within as little as 48 hours. And we are establishing the command and control units in the three Baltic countries, Poland, Romania, and Bulgaria. And this is just the beginning. So we will really see fundamental changes in the way NATO is doing collective defense, increasing our collective defense as a response to what we have seen Russia is doing in Ukraine and in Moldova and other countries.
Mr. Secretary General, I want to ask you to address an issue that the German defense minister, I thought, wisely put on the table at the very beginning of her remarks, which is that what we're seeing in Ukraine and what many analysts fear could be a possibility elsewhere is what we call hybrid warfare, where local forces armed and trained from the outside, in this case NATO alleges by Russia, are operating, but it's not the traditional invasion across a border, but something different, something hybrid. And the fear is that NATO, in its doctrine, in its forces, in its capability, in its mindset, really isn't prepared for that world of hybrid warfare. So let me ask you, are there new things that you think NATO should do to get ready for this? Take a specific instance. A NATO member in the Baltics faces Russian speakers in its population who are citizens of that country who suddenly sees a radio station, a whole part of the country, and declare, as has happened in eastern Ukraine, that they're fighting for their rights. How does NATO respond to that? Is that an Article 5 issue if the country decides that its sovereignty is threatened? How would you answer that?
NATO is ready to defend all allies against any threat, and we see now an increased threat stemming from the concept of hybrid warfare. But I would like to underline that hybrid warfare is nothing new. I mean, hybrid warfare is about the combination of military means and non-military means. It's about covert actions and overt actions, and it's about deception. And actually, I think that the first hybrid warfare we know is the Trojan horse. So we have seen it before, but the new thing is that it's larger scale. It's taking place close to our borders. So we have to focus more on the concept of hybrid warfare, and that's exactly what we are doing. For instance, reduced warning time, deception, increases the importance of readiness preparedness. And that's the reason why we are increasing the readiness and preparedness of our forces. Deception also increases the need for intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. And that's the reason why one important element of the readiness action plan is to increase our intelligence capabilities. And special operation forces might be extremely important in a hybrid situation. So this is part of the adaptation which we now are undergoing, is to also increase our ability to fight hybrid warfare.
I think we'll come back to the question of hybrid warfare and how to respond, but I want to turn to Federica Mogherini, who is the EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs, the chief EU diplomat. For this audience, it is a point of special pride for the German Marshall Fund that she is a graduate of the Marshall Memorial Fellows Program, which is central to what GMF is. We're glad to see our graduates going to high places.
That's why it's named High Representative.
You are now you can't get any higher for a German Marshall Memorial Fellow. I want to ask you, you just had a summit meeting of EU leaders here in Brussels yesterday. And today also. And you were talking about many of the issues that are connected to our panel. And I want to ask you about two. And I want to start with the question of the Minsk II agreement that, in theory, was going to de-escalate the situation in Ukraine. And I want to ask you for a progress report on how Minsk II is going, what areas are solid, what areas are not, what violations you see. And then the question that I know you discussed, what about sanctions? What about additional sanctions? What would trigger them? What about reduction of sanctions? What's the situation where this famous exit ramp might be possible in terms of reduced sanctions?
Yeah, first of all, let me say that we had 2 days European Council, and I find it significant the fact that yesterday we discussed about Ukraine and Russia, but today we discussed about Libya, and I think we should keep this in the framework, because we don't have
come
only
back, give us a Minsk West, to answer, and then we'll come back to back to Libya.
Let me also correct you, if I can. I wouldn't refer to Minsk II. I would refer to the agreement that was reached in Minsk on a package of implementation measures for Minsk. We have only one Minsk agreement. I think there is someone here in the room, a Secretary General of the OSCE sitting there, that could give us a very good report on the implementation and the monitoring of the implementation when it comes to the two main starting points of the agreement, the ceasefire and the withdrawal of heavy weapons. The European Union is Exactly, supporting the OSCE in monitoring this in different ways. If you want, I can go into the details. But it's also doing another thing that is included in this package of implementation measures. While we are speaking here...
Give us an overall, is Minsk working in its current version working or not?
Let me share what I discussed with President Poroshenko in this respect. So I take that side. Its situation is much, much better than it used to be. Not perfect yet. So you don't have a white or black picture. You have a situation that is much better than before the meeting in Minsk and the agreement in Minsk, even if with some violations. And I think that we need to concentrate more and more on the measures we have to put in place to make it work on the ceasefire, also on the implementation of measures that need to be done on the Ukrainian side, reforms and reform of the constitution, local elections and so on, and also what refers to European Union role. While we are speaking now, there is a trilateral dialogue, European Union, Russia and Ukraine on gas, exactly in these hours here in Brussels. And the same we are restarting on the implementation of the trade agreement. So there are steps in the right direction. It will definitely take more political will, more time to have a complete positive picture. I hope we will get there, but it's not now.
And what about sanctions? What was the sanctions discussion?
Are related to this, because we have decided yesterday night that the lifting of the sanctions or keeping the sanctions will be linked only to the full implementation of the Minsk agreement. So the decision of the heads of state and government is that in the coming months, as you know, we don't have to take decisions in these days because the sanctions we have in place are expiring at the end of July. Before the end of July, we will make an assessment of where we are with the implementation. The Minsk agreement foresees that the control of the border, for instance, goes back to the Ukrainian authorities by the end of the year, if everything goes well. I would expect that sanctions will be linked to this, and so would not be lifted before the full implementation of the Minsk agreement, but the decision formally will be taken later on.
We'll come back to Libya and maybe Iran, but I want to give our Russian guest a chance to respond to a number of comments that have been made. So I want to introduce Konstantin Kosachev, who is the chairman of the International Affairs Committee of the Russian Federation Council, who's with us today. And as I told him before we came out here, I want to ask Mr. Kosachev the question that I find people ask in every conversation I attend about Russia in Washington or around the world, and that is, how does President Vladimir Putin look at the world? Does he have, as he said, a sense that the end of the Soviet Union was the catastrophe of his lifetime? And is he trying to build back some of the power and prestige that was lost? How does that translate in the current crisis in Ukraine? How does President Putin, the millions of Russians who obviously support him, how do they view this in terms of Russian national interests? So maybe you could begin there, and then we'll go to some other questions.
Thank you, David. One, I would definitely prefer to speak about millions of Russians rather than Mr. Putin, because Mr. Putin represents people not just as a president of Russia, but he is a very wise man, understanding perfectly well how people in Russia feel about things happening around Russia. And if we go back to the history a little bit, I believe that when the Cold War was starting to get over, many things happened and many documents were signed. I believe that when the Cold War was starting to get over, many things, CSC at that moment, no, it's not OSC, but CSC is mentioned frequently, and the Council of Europe is mentioned frequently, three of them. How many times is NATO mentioned in that document describing the future arrangements of security policy in Europe? Not a single time. How many times the European Union mentioned the European community at the moment? Just once, in a paragraph describing the economic cooperation in Europe. So neither NATO nor the European Union were parts of a deal made at that moment by the Soviet Union and other states, the United States of America included, for the future Europe. What started to happen next? Because many people think that all troubles are related personally to the current president of Russia, Mr. Putin. We could make good deals with Mr. Yeltsin, and as soon as Mr. Putin arrived, we cannot make any good deals any longer. This is absolutely a false description. Russia definitely has changed, but it has nothing to do with the personalities. During the 90s, Russia withdrew all military bases from Eastern Europe, withdrew all military bases from former Soviet republics, with exception of bilateral agreements regulating that, moved all or essential forces away from the European part of Russia out to Siberia behind Urals. We never started any military operation anywhere. We laid down our military bases in Vietnam and Cuba, and so on and so forth. What did NATO do? Just a second. What did NATO do? I would not describe how NATO expanded. I would not describe how NATO did not ratify the adopted CFE treaty and other things. One thing which was crucial: the 24th of March 1999. I do not know how many people will remember it. What was the date? The 24th of March 1999, in the first time in the history of modern Europe, NATO started to bomb a European country. At that moment, an integral country, Yugoslavia, started to bomb it for the reason Mr. Milosevic rejected NATO to deploy forces in a part of this country. So if you would call something an occupation of a part of an independent European state, I would call the Kosovo. I would recall the Kosovo case for that. So Crimea, the Ukrainian crisis, is definitely not the first tragic episode in the modern history of Europe.
With respect, I think you've given us a clear sense of the sense of grievance that Russians view this history since the end of the Cold War. And I think that's a clear answer to my question. I do want to ask you, looking at the immediate crisis that we face, that Russia faces, the West faces in Ukraine, whether a zero sum outcome, in other words, one side wins and one side loses, is inevitable, or whether some kind of compromise, like what's envisioned in Minsk, is possible. Would you be comfortable, would the people you speak for in Russia be comfortable with an Ukraine that at once looks east to Moscow, to Russia, and looks west to Europe? Can you live with that?
Well, it is definitely not inevitable. And Russia, all these years, proposed both to NATO and to the European Union to do something together. The first Ukrainian crisis was about gas, natural gas. Everybody would remember here that the Russian proposal initially had always been, all the time, let us sit together, the European Union, Ukraine, and Russia, and talk about that. The answer was no. This is about us and Ukraine, this is about us and Russia, and we will not discuss it in a trilateral format. Later on, when we had other problems with Ukraine, our message, like the association agreement, for example, our message to the European Union again was, let us sit together and from the very beginning start talking about the future problems which may arise in case this association agreement enters into power. The answer, unfortunately, was no, thank you. Russia has nothing to do with it. We will speak about that with Ukraine.
But what about now?
Russia,
I mean, that's how we got here. What about now?
Same goes for now. We are in the Minsk process. We are very interested in having this process finalized. And I'm very unhappy to see the linkage which was created yesterday by the European Union, the implementation of Minsk agreements vis-a-vis sanctions. Because I am afraid that there is at least one country in Europe, and now I mean Ukraine, which is in conflict with Russia, which is probably not interested in having these Minsk agreements implemented, for the simple reason, as soon as they are implemented, Russia is out of sanctions. And I am afraid that at least certain forces in Ukraine will start to create additional problems for the Minsk agreements, for the Minsk process, just for the simple reason they want to keep Russia inside of sanctions. So this linkage provokes certain problems in the future, which we definitely would like to avoid.
Let me turn to our American representative, Victoria Nuland, who is Assistant Secretary of State for Eurasian Affairs, who is a leading conceptualizer and implementer of U.S. policy. And I want to begin, Madam Assistant Secretary, with a question, again, that would come up in any discussion group in Washington, or I dare say anywhere else now. And that is the question of whether the United States and other allies should be providing defensive weapons, but lethal weapons, to Ukrainian forces that are facing in their southeast a continuing military threat. This has been a debate that's gone back and forth in the administration. It's well known. There are different points of view within the administration. Maybe it would help if you just sort of took us into the, you know, the virtual situation room and just what are the arguments that you hear in favor of doing this? And then at the end of the day, why is the president, as he said publicly, decided that this isn't appropriate U.S. policy?
Well, first, David, just to say that on this particular subject, not of defensive security support, but of lethal weaponry, the president has not made a decision. You're right. It's a hotly debated topic in Washington. It's a hotly debated topic transatlantically, because one of the great strengths of our approach, our response to the Ukraine crisis, our response to Russia's aggression in Ukraine, has been that the countries of Europe and the United States and Canada and our G7 partners have been very united. And so it's important in any decisions that any of us make about how we're going to support Ukraine, whether it's economically, politically, or in security terms, that we also discuss across the Atlantic. First, let me say that the United States has provided significant security support to Ukraine throughout this crisis, almost $120 million worth. We're getting ready to start training Ukrainian forces in western Ukraine. We are providing things like counterfire radar batteries that allow them to see where they're being fired on, night scopes, the kinds of things that will allow them to be more capable. With regard to whether you take that to a more lethal level, on the side of those who favor, there's the Ukrainian request itself. They are asking for more support to defend themselves. There's also the fact that we've seen month on month more lethal weaponry of a higher caliber, of more sophistication, poured into Ukraine by their by the separatist Russian allies, and it's, you know, now getting to the level where the kinds of equipment that the Ukrainian forces are confronting are much more sophisticated than what they have. So the question becomes, if you are facing a T-90 tank with a T-72 tank, ought you to have anti-tank weapons to at least level the playing field? If you are facing Smerch artillery, which can go 20 kilometers with your own local artillery, should you have some capability against that? That's the argument in favor. The argument opposed is that clearly this would constitute an escalation on the battlefield. Would it be responded by further escalation on the part of Russia, such that the whole thing becomes more bloody, more violent, and those who suffer most are the people of Ukraine? So that is the debate. It is a fair fight. Obviously, our first hope right now, as High Representative Mogherini said, is to see the Minsk agreements fully implemented, to see a full ceasefire, to see a full pullback of heavy weapons, to see real politics begin in the East, real elections, not fake elections like the kind we had in Crimea or appointing of Russian proxies, so that those elected leaders can begin to enjoy decentralized powers that Kyiv has now offered, local policing, rights of free language, rights to keep a lot of their tax dollars, rights to make their own economic agreements, and then can we get that border closed?
Just to make sure.
Kyiv has not provided this format yet. They speak about that, but it's never done in a written form. It's just promises, and these promises are preconditioned by very many other things. So people in southeastern Ukraine feel uncertain about whether they will be able to make deals with Kyiv or not.
Konstantin, it's just counterfactual. The Ukrainian Rada in September passed the special status law the first time, which granted huge amounts of independence and decentralized power to the east, but there was the condition that there had to be elections under Ukrainian law. Instead of that, there were fake elections in November that were not recognized. Now they've offered it again. The Rada earlier this week passed an even enhanced package. So the question is, are the separatists courageous enough to stand for election under Ukrainian law, and then they will have the right to make their own economic deals, to have their own police, to decide what language is spoken out there inside Ukraine? That would be, that's what Moscow has always said it wanted for those people. That's what, when Secretary Kerry was negotiating with Lavrov
but
in the winter,
if you read attentively the Minsk agreements, there is a word there, a dialogue to be started on the 30th day after the ceasefire is in power. Do we have this dialogue as for now? Is it initiated by Kyiv? No. There is no dialogue at all. Just you have to take it or leave it. It's not a position which leads us to a political solution,
but
I'm afraid.
Konstantin, on the specific question that Toria asked, would the separatists, the forces in southeast Ukraine, be prepared to stand for elections so that they had power under the sovereignty of an overall Ukraine of which they were part? Are they prepared for that? Is Russia prepared to support that?
I do not represent here these people. And I would love to see a situation where they have agreed among them about any possible solutions and ways out. And I believe that Russia would be happy to support any agreement reached between the conflicting parts. So if the Minsk agreements include certain steps to be made step by step, they are to be made step by step. They are not to be interpreted additionally the way it is done now by Kyiv.
So I want to close off this little colloquy, which I told the panelists before we started that I wanted them to interrupt each other, and they took me up on it. So I want to ask Toria to close this out by just responding to what Konstantin said. Is there, do you hear in anything that he said, a pathway toward confidence building, toward greater dialogue, toward a structure that would reinforce what has been a pretty fragile Minsk structure?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the number one thing is for Russia to stop sending arms over the border so that we can have real politics, have a real ceasefire. Look, what Kyiv has offered is its own package of decentralized power. After an election, if those elected want to have a different kind of relationship, an enhanced relationship with the federal government, they'll be able to participate in a broader process which is going on all year in Ukraine, which is the redrafting of their constitution, where decentralization across the country is very much on board. But what Kyiv is not prepared to do is negotiate the future of the country with a bunch of guys installed by Moscow. They've got to be elected.
So I want to turn back to Secretary General Stoltenberg, and I want to take you back to what I thought was the central question of the previous panel, which was whether NATO's collective self-defense commitments are fully credible in a period where the time it required to mobilize NATO forces, even with the improvements, remain long, in a period where hybrid warfare blurs that both your clarity about what's happening on the ground, your ability to attribute actions to others, and then the request for Article 5 support. I just would like to hear you talk about what worries you as an incoming Secretary General about how to make this commitment that the members of this alliance are prepared to defend each other's security in an increasingly dangerous world. How do you make that commitment more believable?
Well, so I guess the right answer is to say that I'm worried, because people should be worried in a difficult world. But at the same time, I'd like to say to you that I'm impressed what I have seen since I came to NATO headquarters in October. Because what has really impressed me is the ability of NATO to adapt. And that's actually the strength of NATO, is that we are able to adapt when the security environment is changing. So NATO is the strongest alliance, military alliance in history. We have been able to provide deterrence, protection of all allies for more than six decades. And we did so by focusing on collective defense for 40 years, since 1949 to the end of the... since to the fall of the Berlin Wall in 89. And then we focused for many years on crisis management, Afghanistan, Kosovo, and those challenges. Now we are in the process where we have to both focus on crisis management in the south, but at the same time refocus and increase our focus on collective defense. And that's exactly what we are doing.
Let's take a very specific, practical example of the threats of 2015, for which NATO, you know, may not be fully prepared, and that's a cyber attack. Can you imagine a cyber attack triggering an Article 5 request by the country that was attacked to NATO? How would NATO respond to that? I mean, imagine a completely disabling attack where the electrical system goes down, the ability to communicate goes down, and the country says, "We're under attack." How would NATO, on your current structure and doctrine, respond to that?
So the basic message is that NATO is ready to defend all allies against any threat, and that an attack on one ally is an attack on all 28. Then we see that the world is changing, and therefore, for instance, we are addressing both hybrid, as I mentioned, but also cyber threats. We are doing something more. We are focusing on how we can increase our own ability to defend NATO infrastructure, but also helping allies with increasing their capabilities to defend their
own.
But
a cyber attack on one would be viewed as a cyber attack on all and responded to as such?
Any attack on any ally is something that we are responding to, because we are defending all allies against any kind of attack. And then, of course, we will assess, we will address any kind of attack.
Constantine.
May I ask a question? Are you going to bomb a country which is supposed to be behind a cyber attack against a NATO member state?
So there are
you going to bomb it? Are you going to start a cyber attack against this country?
Is this a planning question, Constantine?
It is not. No, I just want to have NATO as transparent as possible, because sometimes we do not have answers and we have to take our own security measures for the simple reason. For the simple reason, we do not understand perfectly well the intentions of NATO in certain cases, because NATO. This is a big difference between NATO and Russia. NATO is involved in many military operations outside of NATO, which creates a certain security risk for any country in the world. This is why I'm asking a question: what would happen in case a certain member states of NATO would declare Russia, with or without reasons, does not matter, would declare Russia as a country behind a cyber attack?
Well, let's get Jens's response, because it's, you know, cyber is the frontier, and it's really complicated to know who did it, to know, you know, what to do about that. What is your thinking, without giving us the planning memo?
Well,
or
so we will
give us
do
the planning
what's,
memo later.
What's necessary to do to protect all allies. And and of course, then we have to protect also those who are attacked by cyber attacks. But I'm not saying, I'm not going to tell you exactly how we're going to do that, because we're going to do that in a way which enable us to protect all allies. And that's the main message. And we will know when it happens, and we will respond in a proportionate and defensive way.
This is NATO is unpredictable, and we have to be prepared for any possible development.
Well, so we really are back to the Cold War. You know, strategic ambiguity. I remember reading, Dr. Brzezinski and Dr. Kissinger. We all know the values of not being just sure what the other side would do. And maybe we are back to that world where you're going to say, you can't be sure how we'll respond, and Secretary General will say we can't be sure how we'd act.
David, as a planning matter, can we ask Konstantin how Moscow would respond if it thought it had been cyber attacked by one of the NATO countries?
I think he's just been asked.
He's
that.
Not going to.
No usage of military force. Definitely not. This is my absolutely clear answer. I am not entitled to give that answer, but this is my conviction that that would be the answer of Russia.
But the big difference is that we are a defensive alliance. You are sending troops into neighboring countries, and you are violating
international
law. We are not
sending troops into a neighboring country. Mr. Breedlove believes we do. Mr. Breedlove believes we do, but we do not.
But you send troops into Crimea.
Present evidence. I would recall the discussion in Munich recently. Many of people here were there. You would remember how Mr. Poroshenko presented 5 or 6 passports, Russian passports, for the audience. The same day, the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs sent an official request to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine. Please give us any details, names, numbers, copies, anything. Until now, there is no answer. So everybody believes that was an evidence. But that was not an evidence. Same goes for very many other reports delivered by Mr. Breedlove or other Americans who are very much in favor of proving that Russia is involved. Russia is not involved with regular forces in southeastern Ukraine.
We will come back to this, but I want to turn to the senior diplomat in the room, the high representative. And I want to ask Frederica to any.
I don't have the proofs.
Thoughts that you have on this, but more broadly, before this session began, we talked as a group about seeing if this conversation could include the question of how you knit this world, which is ripping. We can hear it ripping. Knit it back together. And
we're not going to that direction here.
No, you can just pick up the fabric as it rips. But if you'd like to speak to that, and also we talked earlier about Libya, and I'd love to know what the latest is about the Iran talks, if you want to tell us.
I think this is the 10th anniversary of the Brussels Forum, right? Mm-hmm. And it would be good if we could also, I understand the format is challenging, think of how the Brussels Forum could look like in 10 years. And I hope, I guess, we won't be doing this again in 10 years. This is the big question for me. How do we think our relationship can develop? Because maybe it's for a generational issue, I don't give up to the idea that we overcame the Cold War thinking. Otherwise, Europe would be torn, and borders around Europe would be torn also in 10 years from now. Ukraine, I think, means literally frontier, right? It would be good if we could go back sometime, once we manage to implement fully the Minsk agreement, to understand how we can live together, because
absolutely,
we are neighbors and you don't change geography. This is one of the few things you don't change, your parents and your neighbors. And I would give you news. The European Union is for Russia the first trading partner and the first investor. How do we think in 10 years from now we will relate to each other? I mean, I have the European answer. I would like to have the Russian answer. European Union was always a project based on cooperation inside its border and outside. And we have developed a sense of partnership and cooperation also with the Russian Federation in the last 10, 15 years. And the big question we have, strategic question we have, is what is happening in Ukraine the end of this, or is it something we can discuss, my point of view, a violation of international law, something that can be overcome with the restoration of the international law and principles and peace in Ukraine and territorial integrity of Ukraine, and we can go back to cooperation, or is that time over and we have to think of something different from the Cold War because we will never get kind of it?
Well said. Konstantin, what's your answer?
Well said. Thank you very much for that comment. You used now words, I have the European answer, I would like to see the Russian answer. We are Europeans, we in Russia, we are not aliens, and Europe is also our continent. So you and nobody else, you don't have a European answer, you have a European Union answer.
I have the European Union answer.
I would prefer that we all would try to start working on a European answer, because as for now, you all the time speak about how happy Europe is with the European Union and with NATO. The way what is good for General Motors is good for America, but what is good for NATO is good for NATO, but not for the whole Europe. What is good for the European Union is good for the European Union, but not necessarily for the whole Europe. We need to have an inclusive agenda for future Europe.
Now, I
the
need
whole
to make
Europe
sure I'm
with Russia included, because as for now, Russia is excluded. We are not privileged
to be
a part of NATO or the European Union.
A Russian veto over European, you're saying Russia's part of Europe, so we get to, we have a vote in what Europe decides, if I'm hearing. Troika, can you straighten this out for me?
Well, we're obviously not European, although many of us are of European stock. But what binds us as a community and what we hoped we would be able to add Russia to in all the years after the Cold War, and which many people in this room have worked on, was a set of common values. And what we want, what we hoped, was that Russia too would want to live in a world where you can't change borders by force, that Russia would want to live in a community where the individual rights of every human being are respected no matter who they love or what color they are or who they worship, where media would be free, where we would be able to make open, free trade, low tariff deals with each other. That is what binds the United States to the countries of the EU and NATO. That is what was the basis of all of the work we did in the 90s and the aught years to try to work with Russia, whether it was the NATO-Russia Council, whether it was Russia-EU collaboration on economy,
strategic
et cetera.
Partnership.
Strategic partnership. But in the context of a Russia that is not interested in those rules of the road, then we're obviously constrained in how much we can do together. We'll still try to do as much as we can, but we will protect and partner with those who want to join in that basic human compact.
I want to, Konstantin, before turning to you, I want to ask you to focus this a little bit more. There is a very specific way in which the world of partnership, dialogue, cooperation is unraveling in ways that are dangerous for your country, for Europe, for the United States. And that is the way in which key arms control agreements that were the product of generations of work through the detente years are beginning to come undone. The Conventional Forces in Europe agreement seems to be basically, a meeting last week was a complete failure. People walked away. The efforts to get a New START agreement that would have additional cuts in strategic weapons, much discussion of that several years ago. President Obama clearly interested in it, no action on that. And now, to me, most worrisome are accusations on both sides that medium-range nuclear missiles, the so-called INF agreement, which was really the the foundation stone of the detente, the end of the Cold War, that's now coming in question. So I want to ask each of you, please, briefly, to address this specific way in which we are slipping back into the world of the Cold War as these arms control agreements begin to unravel. Konstantin, if you'd start.
We are definitely, absolutely in favor of keeping as many arms control agreements in power as possible. CFA Treaty. We have experts here. We all remember how the adopted CFA Treaty was ratified by Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Ukraine. Four countries. None of them belongs to NATO. NATO, not a single NATO member state, ratified and adopted CFA Treaty. So now we still have the original text, the original CFA Treaty, if we still have it, where the Baltic states are a part of the Leningrad military district of the Soviet Union. This is the text we have and we try to save. The adopted treaty was the way out. The option was ruined by the refusal of NATO countries to ratify it, to let it enter into force. This is not our responsibility. Sorry.
Well, what about
ABM? ABM treaty. ABM treaty. We know how the United States of America did about ABM treaty. Shall we not speak about that because
ABM
it's about
is a
transatlantic
whole different set of issues. Let's talk about
also important,
INF, which
ABM
is right
treaty.
Here in
Please
Europe.
Address that question to Victoria about ABM treaty. Do not forget.
I'll ask her, but I want to ask you about INF.
We are definitely in favor of keeping it, and definitely we will do our best in order to keep it. There are certain questions from the American side towards Russians. There are certain questions from Russ towards Americans. I am not an expert on that. As far as I understand, there are questions which are to be clarified. We need to have discussions about that, and I believe we need to confirm on both sides that we want to have this treaty to be in power. This is my absolute conviction.
Federica, do you have thoughts about this aspect of our slipping back toward the Cold War?
There is no slipping back. I mean, the history is gone. We have to look forward. The world has changed. We are now focusing so much on this. I understand this is the issue of this session. But we are not focusing on the fact that we share some security threats. Proliferation,
absolutely.
Terrorism, destabilization all around the Mediterranean, absolutely. Middle East, Afghanistan is still there. I mean, in a transition, but we should not. I mean, 2 years ago we were focusing only on this year of transition for Afghanistan, and we turned the page too quickly on the crisis, and we don't see the crisis coming. Africa, huge threats we share. The win-win situation could come only if we manage to make the common interests emerge and try to act in a responsible way. And obviously the security architecture around our continent, Europe, our continental Europe, is a major interest we share. And I skipped the question on the Iranian nuclear file. I didn't want to skip the question.
Please,
but this is one of the issues where, for instance, the cooperation between Russia, the European Union, the US, and others, China, is working and is fruitful. As well as, for instance, on the Middle East peace process, we will need to sit down together and try to restart. On the Syrian chemical weapons it worked last year. Other issues, I hope Libya is something else on which we can work together in the UN Security Council. We have other challenges we could work on. And to be completely sincere, I think that the whole set of efforts that was done in the recent years, the New START agreement, for instance, of disarmament and non-proliferation agreements, it would be really an historical mistake to throw that away. Because again, it's not a matter of going back to the Cold War. The world is not bipolar anymore. It's not multipolar either. It's just no order. We should try and find a way of defining some sort of order. And it's already 2 decades we have wasted after the end of the Cold War without drawing any kind of design of world order. Maybe it's time to do it.
Yeah, Jens, do you have thoughts in this? I thought there was a very useful bridge, what knitting back together would look like, the identification of areas of common interest and working on those. For example, is NATO... in trying to find ways to share intelligence, either as a group or through member countries, with Russia, with other countries that are affected by violent extremism in the Middle East. Are there examples where you're working in that direction as opposed to the more confrontational issues we've been discussing?
So we have suspended our practical cooperation with Russia as a result of what we saw in Ukraine last spring. We continue to have open channels for political contact. But let me just address, in a way, the fundamental question you asked in the beginning, whether this is a zero-sum or a win-win situation. And I can recall when I was a student, and also later on when I worked in the Norwegian Central Bureau of Statistics, and I worked on economic theory and game theory. And then we learned about cooperative games and win-win situations, and non-cooperative games and zero-sum outfalls or outcomes. And the main message then was that it all depends on the rules. If you have the right rules and you have a minimum trust, then you are able to move from a zero-sum situation to a win-win. And the problem now is that we don't have the rules, or actually we have the rules, but they are not respected. And therefore we don't have the trust. And that's the reason why we are moving from a win-win situation towards something which is more and more like a zero-sum game. And we cannot go back again to the win-win situation without enforcing respect for the rules, mm-hmm. because that's a precondition for trust and respect for rules is a precondition for win-win. And this actually undermines both arms control, it undermines economic cooperation, trade, and it undermines security in Europe. So when NATO is so focused on the respect for basic rules, like respecting the border of your neighbor, it's not a very advanced, it's not very, difficult rule. It's to see the border and to respect it. Then we focus on that because that's so fundamental for the idea of coming back to a situation where we can have a win-win situation instead of a zero-sum situation.
Tori, let me ask you for a final comment here, and then I'm going to actually take the first question from the audience for you as well. So thoughts that you have on either this, to me, very worrisome unraveling of arms control, in particular in the INF dimension, and then we'll turn to the audience.
I agree with Jens that you can't have win-wins without trust. Mm. We all want win-wins. That's what we've devoted our professional lives to. That's what we need for our populations. But without trust, you can't do it. And you're not going to have trust if you don't have truth. So when you have a country denying that it has troops in another country's territory, there's no trust. When you have a country denying that it is testing a new missile that may not be compliant with INF, it's hard to have trust. Our president has wanted to do not less arms control, but more arms control. He has wanted to cut strategic weapons further. I was sent out to Europe as his negotiator to try to do a daughter of CFE, to do a brand new conventional treaty. We couldn't get it done because Russia refused to talk about its forces that were stationed in Georgia, Moldova, against the will of those governments. So we would love to do more, but it requires trust, truth, addressing the situation as it is.
I saw a question from the audience for you, and I'm going to paraphrase it, but if somebody will take ownership of this question, it was directed to you, and it was on this question of defensive weapons for the Ukrainians, and it essentially asked, is there something that a continuation or increase in Russian shipment of weapons across the border as our intelligence collects that information that would change the balance in this decision, which has been pending now for some months? I hope I've stated that right.
Look, as I said, this is the president's decision to make. I think I laid out the considerations. Obviously, we're watching what happens on the ground. We're hoping for, working for, the best outcome, which would be the full implementation of Minsk, which would make the whole question moot. But if that is, that does not happen, if in fact we see a resurgence of aggression and violence, that'll change the calculation also.
Okay. The first hand I saw was a gentleman here in the second row, and then I see lots of hands waving. I'll try to get to as many people as I can.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm Roland Freudenstein from the Wilfried Machtens Center for European Studies, which is the think tank of the European People's Party, not to be confused with People's Republic. Now, my question to Secretary Nuland. We heard in the previous session from Secretary Brzezinski about accommodation and ruling out NATO membership for Ukraine. Would that be acceptable on the basis of everything we've stood for after the end of the Cold War, countries free to choose their alliances? Wouldn't that be a return to spheres of influence and buffer zones? And one question to Chairman Kosachev. In the spirit of win-win and de-escalation that figures so highly in the description and title of this session, wouldn't it be a brilliant idea for those Russian military planes that have been spotted near passenger flights to switch their transponders back on?
So let's put that. What about those transponders, Konstantin? That scares people.
I'm not an expert on that, but as far as I'm informed by our experts, NATO aircrafts do not switch on transponders in many cases either. Would you deny it? Would you say now that each and every NATO airplane does have an air transponder on? If you do say it now, I will go back to my experts. But as far as I am informed, this is more or less a common practice in both cases. I don't like it. This is dangerous, but it's not unique for Russia.
Jens, do you want to respond?
The aircrafts under NATO command turn on their transponders. And for instance, all the aircrafts we have in the Baltic air policing mission, they turn on the transponders.
So there are no cases of transponders switched off by NATO.
Airplanes
this is important because
I
will have to ask my experts in that case.
Planes under NATO command turn on their transponders.
All right. That's
okay. I'll check it out.
That's the answer. I'm going to turn to the woman in the third row, and then
but
to Congressman
Issa. Question.
Sorry,
was there
something for Toria? Sorry.
There was a question about Ukraine and NATO. It is the longstanding position of the United States across administrations, Republican and Democratic, that any Euro-Atlantic country has the right to choose its alliance, has the right to ask. That's a different matter than the hard work that a country has to do, representatives from many of the countries who have done it in this room, to meet the rights and responsibilities of membership. I think this is a false question to be discussing right now because Ukraine has so much work to do to strengthen and heal its economy, its democracy, its politics. And it is focused on that work, which is why President Poroshenko says the question's not at the top of the table. But as a general matter, absolutely.
If that finishes, Mr. Freudenstein, yes, madam.
Teresa Fallon, European Institute of Asian Studies. Since Victoria Nuland is also in charge of Eurasia, and I'd like to the whole panel, but Russia has never been weaker in modern history. Xi Jinping's Silk Road Initiative is an ambitious strategic vision for Eurasia. How do you see Sino-Russian competition in this region shaping up, especially now that Russia is so, with the sanctions and problems in Ukraine, it is unlikely that Russia will be content to be a satellite of China. So can we open this up a little bit to the broader geostrategic issues at stake here? Thank you.
Who wants to address that? Konstantin, would you like to speak to... I certainly sense that Beijing is concerned about Russia's situation in Ukraine. My own visits there, most recently in December. Do you want to speak about Russia and Asia? You have an extensive dialogue with Japan going on. What about Russia and Asia?
Well, we are in a perfect relationship with China. As for now, we never had as good relations with China as we have now. We do not have any contradictions with China on Ukraine.
yesterday when there was an informal meeting of the Security Council discussing the situation in Ukraine, both Russia and China did not attend. This is another confirmation that we do not have at least some principal contradictions. The current sanction policy towards Russia does create additional motivation for Russia to have other projects with China and other countries which do not sanction Russia. And I believe that when the sanctions are lifted up, it will be very difficult for many European and American companies to come back to Russia for the simple reason these markets will be already taken. That's it.
Congressman Issa. A microphone, I'm sure, will make its way to you. Tout suite.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. I'll sort of play the U.S.-Russian relation, if I could, for a moment, but not to leave anyone out. Returning to cyber, I think the sort of, I'll call it false narrative of, you know, would you use kinetic energy if, or kinetic attack if somebody were to do a cyber attack, probably was a little over the top, even by Russian U.S. standards. But when we had recently a likely North Korean attack against the U.S., and quite frankly, oddly enough, China's connection to North Korea went down for a period of time. Some might call that a measured response. Neither confirming nor denying it, aren't there, in fact, necessary measured responses that NATO, European Union, the United States are going to have to develop and consistently let friend and foe alike know would be a reaction? And then, Dmitry, I would only ask you,
Constantine,
I'm sorry. I would only ask you one question is...
Who is Dmitry?
We'll find him later. As the U.S.
He just comes elevated up, you to prime minister, I think.
which, as you know, can be fatal, so be very careful. But on your side, if Armenia were to launch a cyber attack, would you cut off their natural gas?
Let's take first Toria and then Constantine.
Well, first of all, Congressman, you've forgotten more than I'll ever know about U.S. capabilities in the cyber arena. Yeah, exactly. But just to elaborate on what Jens said earlier, the truth is that NATO collectively has already helped allies respond to cyber attack, whether it's helping them restore network, move to other network, do the forensics to figure out what happened, harden, et cetera. With regard to countermeasures, there's a full menu of things one could think about. But we are obviously, as an alliance, trying to improve and perfect those kinds of things as the technology and the environment changes.
So measured response and kinetic attack was never on the table.
Look, none of us is going to say you do X and we'll do Y. That's just not the way it should work. But there are plenty of responses short of kinetic that would be impactful.
Could I just jump in and ask before we get to Constantine, wouldn't there be some value, as Congressman Issa suggests, in just from a deterrence standpoint, in greater discussion of what actions might provoke other actions so that you wouldn't have a kind of, you know, you're not going to bomb a country that disrupts your electrical system, but what would you do? Wouldn't a greater public discussion, as was the case during the Cold War, to establish norms of deterrence, wouldn't that be useful?
You don't manage to get out of this Cold War, right? I'm sorry, but I'm...
Well, you're right.
Because the starting point was the win-win.
Yeah.
And how do we get out of this? But my impression is that the questions themselves bring us back really to a last century, last millennium.
Well, let's...
David. Okay.
Sorry, but...
You have to take it.
Granting your point, and being an atavistic 19th century person anyway, let me still ask...
She says you're showing your age.
No,
well,
no, that's what's happening. No, Toria, I'm the senior. I'm the senior diplomat here, so...
You're the...
Get 21st century,
you're
baby.
Marshall...
David,
We will not use your wisdom and experience against her, nor her youth and inexperience against her.
That's spoken like Ronald Reagan. If Jens has a thought, let me turn to him.
We have never exactly spelled out exactly how we will respond to different kinds of situations or attacks, but we have a history of more than 6 decades where everything that we have done is proportionate, it's defensive, and it's completely in line with all of our international commitments.
Yes.
So just to look on our history and our record, I think you can just trust that the way we will respond to any cyber attack will be proportionate, it will be defensive, and it will be in line with our international commitments.
Helpful. Konstantin.
Well, I got a question about Armenia attacking Russia and our possible response on gas deliveries. I would like to remind you then that the year of 2008, when we had this deep crisis with Georgia and tanks were shooting at each other, Russian gas deliveries to Georgia were not interrupted for a single minute. They continued during the whole crisis, and they continue as for now. And this is absolutely something which we will continue to practice, because we do not, there is a common perception that Russia uses energy supplies as a weapon, political or economic weapon. This is not the case. We had certain problems with Ukraine, but the problems were related to our commercial disputes. They were not related to our political disagreements. And I cannot imagine a situation when political disagreements may lead to a situation when we switch off the deliveries of natural gas to any country.
So I'm going to take two final questions from hands that were raised right from the beginning. The woman here in the third row, and then the gentleman there, yes, just under the BrusselsForum.org sign. So, madam, let's collect these two, and then we'll come back to the panel.
My name is Nikki Javel. I'm a former member of the European Parliament. Let's suppose that things go wrong, and in June, the European Union decides to extend the sanctions. We may end up with a destabilized Russia. We have a destabilized Northern Africa. We have destabilized Syria and Middle East. Can Europe afford a destabilized Russia? This is my question.
Powerful question. Let's get one more in the back, and then we'll come back to the panel. If we could get a microphone back to the gentleman who's standing.
David Kramer with the McCain Institute. Russia started the crisis with Ukraine in 2013 not because Ukraine was going to sign an agreement with NATO, but because Ukraine was prepared to sign an agreement with the European Union. So in light of that, I'd like to ask both the Secretary General and the High Representative, are they willing to state that both of your organizations remain open to the prospect one day, even if it's years down the road, for Ukraine, if it meets the criteria, to join both NATO and the European Union? But also, Mr. Secretary General, in Russia's military doctrine, NATO and its enlargement are considered the number one threat and danger to Russia. Is it time for NATO to announce and declare that Russia is a threat to us as well? Thank you.
Those are two good questions. They're sort of the flip side of each other. Let me go down the panel. We'll start with Konstantin, if you would. The first is, you know, as sanctions bite, there's a concern about a destabilized Russia, economic difficulties. Speak to the Russian future. And then there was a very provocative question from David Kramer, which you may also want to respond to. And then we'll go down each of the panelists.
Number one, we are definitely influenced by sanctions, but the damage is not crucial. And Russia will definitely survive whether sanctions are prolonged or not prolonged. Russia is not isolated. We have many other economic partners, and we will continue to live with or without sanctions. Though we are not happy about these sanctions, they have not brought any result in terms of influencing the decision-making process in Russia, and they will not do it in the future either.
You are an expert, Mr. Kramer, and you understand, you know perfectly well that NATO as an organization was never declared in any Russian document as a threat. The expansion of NATO was classified as a challenge and threat, hypothetical threat towards Russian security, and this is where we stand. NATO was never classified as a threat, and we have to be there, and I do not believe that NATO needs to declare Russia as a threat. This is my answer. Am I supposed to give another comment?
No, I have many. I think that's clear, direct. Frederica.
First, a destabilized Russia is not in the interest of the European Union, and I think of the world, because the world we live in is fragile. There was one of the questions on the list asking if we were ready for a major destabilization in the world while we're still recovering from an economic crisis. This is an issue, and it's an issue for Europe. Still, we decided more than 1 year ago that as there was no military mean to face the crisis in Ukraine from the European perspective, the only way of putting pressure on Russia was the economic one. So I wish we could lift the sanctions soon, but it depends on the situation on the ground in Ukraine. And we are not going to leave this kind of principle. And I can guarantee you, I'm confident that the European Union will keep its unity in the decisions on this respect, linking any decisions on sanctions only and purely to the situation on the ground in the east of Ukraine. When it comes to the European perspective of Ukraine, this is not on the table of the Ukrainian authorities. Victoria was saying very clearly, we should focus all, also us, but also the Ukrainian authorities, more and more on the challenges they face internally now, because the real point is the success of Ukraine itself, which is a challenge. President Juncker stated in July, so even before taking office, that we're not going to have enlargement of European Union in the next 5 years, and we have countries that are queuing up since 10 years now. So imagine Ukraine. But we have a treaty. We have an article in the treaty that is very clear, and that it stays. So in that respect, there is no change of the European Union policy, but we have to be realistic and understand that the European perspective of Ukraine is always stated as it is in one article of the treaty, but the situation, the political situation we're facing, Ukraine is facing, and the European Union is facing in supporting Ukraine in its transition, is focusing on something different at the moment.
The Secretary General.
When it comes to enlargement, I think it's very important to underline some fundamental principles, and that is also principles which are enshrined in, for instance, in the Helsinki Final Act, and which all countries, including Russia, has subscribed to. And that is that every nation has the right to decide its own path, including to decide what kind of security arrangements it would like to be part of. So, for instance, whether Ukraine is going to be a member of NATO or not is, first of all, a question which Ukraine has to decide whether they would like to apply. And if they apply, well, we will assess that application in exactly the same way as we will assess any other application for a NATO membership. And that will be a relationship between the aspirant country and the 28 allies. No other country has the right to intervene or to try to veto such a process. And that's a fundamental principle of the sovereignty of individual nations. And it's something which also Russia, at least, subscribed to or supported when they signed the Helsinki Final Act. Then I would like to underline that for me there is no contradiction between the idea of a strong defense and dialogue, a strong defense and accommodation. Actually, for me, it very much works together, because the only way we can have the confidence to engage with Russia is going to be a neighbor, it's going to be there, is to have the confidence and the strength which is provided by strong collective defense, the NATO alliance. That provides the basis for also in the future be able to re-establish some kind of cooperative relationship with Russia. So for me, to increase our collective defense is not a contradiction to at the same time aspire for a more constructive relationship, but it's a way to establish the predictability, the trust, which is needed for a more win-win situation in the future.
Toria, and I just want to say to those who I can't call on, I apologize. I just got a sign from the person who runs this, you know, a knife across my throat, so I apologize. Toria.
Well, just in the interest of being provocative, which is why Karen invites me to things. exactly, yes. Very diplomat. I would just recall an instance in 1993, more than one, in fact, when then-President Boris Yeltsin of Russia raised with senior Americans the prospect of whether Russia would ever be welcomed as a NATO member if it applied. And I also remember conversations when Medvedev was president, when he was asking rhetorically, publicly, whether Russia should aspire to join the European Union, because we were in that period of high economic integration. I would like to live in a world, I would like my children to live in a world where more Russians would be asking themselves the question about whether their future knitted together with us, sharing our values, is in their interest. I would like to live in a world where more Russians had a chance to come and hear what we have to say, to attend our schools, and have an open debate, have that real debate. And what I worry about now is that we are foreclosing the very options that many of us spent our lives trying to work for, which is a closer transatlantic community, truly from Vancouver to Vladivostok. And that's what we should aspire to. And I would like to hope that when we're doing the 25th year anniversary, that might look more possible.
Powerful discussion. It's going to continue the next two days. Those who weren't called on, we're going to have so many panels for you to jump into. Thank you, everyone, for being part of this. Thank you especially to the panelists.